The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women. And so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we centre and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently.
I'm really excited to have Jo Seaman on the podcast today. So Jo is an ADHDer occupational therapist and co-founder of Kaiko Fidgets. Jo is passionate about developing appropriate sensory tools for teens and adults with a focus on harm minimization and emotional regulation. And she uses both her lived experience perspective and her background in occupational therapy to match sensory needs to the right sensory support. Now, Jo, you and I actually met at the ADPA, the Australian ADHD Professionals Association conference last year. And I remember walking into the conference room and just seeing this really cool table with this array of fidgets all over it. And we got into a really awesome conversation that just kind of bounced back and forth. And we were both so excited to be playing with and, you know, telling me about all of the fidgets at Kaiko's Fidgets.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Monique. Yes, I remember my biggest memory is you had the most gorgeous nails. I remember them being pink and they were stunning and you were holding a pink fidget and it just looked amazing. How's that for neuro spicy?
Yes, I really do love the colour pink, to be honest, and I actually use nails as almost a stim toy in themselves, like the sparkliness and the shininess of it and like looking at it and... yeah, it was just so perfect, you know, having matchy-matchy with the pink outfit, the pink nails and the pink fidget.
No, and it was such a great opportunity to actually just connect with other like-minded clinicians and humans that have a passion around ADHD or neurospicy field of practice, and very, very, very affirming.
So, Jo, you've been an occupational therapist for over 20 years and you brought that experience to the business, Kaiko's Fidgets, but you're no longer practicing as an occupational therapist. But we thought we'd really love to have you on because we haven't had an occupational therapist come on the podcast yet and just really wanted to kind of share some of your expertise in this area and talking about sensory regulation, we thought would be really helpful to our listeners.
Yeah, well, thank you. And it's interesting. It was a bit of an accidental journey into doing what I do now. My background as an OT was in community health and aged care. I worked a lot with palliative care. So that was sort of my field of interest and expertise, I guess, throughout my career. But I have two children and both are autistic. And so it was very much a journey of family discovery of sensory that kind of led us to become, specialists in the field of sensory and sort of what that looked like. And it was a nice pairing. Initially, it was really just me as a mum exploring it with my son. And it was great to be able to draw on my occupational therapy background to sort of unpack his needs. Although you can't be your own child's occupational therapist, I discovered. That was, that was the only thing I couldn't do for him. But in terms of exploring his needs. And as we sort of found he got older, he needed something a little bit more suitable for his age, rather than sort of toys and the sort of typical fidgets that were out and about. And so we started making things for him. We had no intention of actually creating a business. It was really just for him. So that's how Kaiko Fidgets was started. It was really just identifying needs for our son, and then it sort of rolled into doing little markets for Kai. And through those markets, we established other people's had different sensory needs. So we sort of explored that. So it was sort of a pairing of a mum, a son, and the OT background. And it sort of just was a sort of a perfect pairing.
I love that so much. And, you know, it sounded like it kind of naturally evolved through your own exploration. And then, you know, you yourself, I think it sounds like you got your diagnosis through perhaps exploring your children and their diagnoses and their needs, which is often the case for a lot of adult, late diagnosed neurodivergent women, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. I honestly would not have pegged myself as neurodiverse. But in going to conferences, ADHD conferences in particular, as I'd sit and listen, I'd be like, oh my goodness, that's me. Oh my goodness, that's me. Oh my goodness, that's me. Because it's just my brain. I thought everybody's brain felt like it was on fire and had 10,000 conversations layering in at once. And hearing even just language around things like dooms piles, it was like, oh, there's a name for it. And I have them everywhere. So, yeah, it was very much through exploring things for Kai that I became more aware. And as I got older too, I think I found it's, I don't know whether it's the craziness of running a business or whether it's perimenopause or the collision of both, but as I became more aware that I was very much ADHD, I became less able to mask as well. So all of a sudden, things that I could do or could push past, all of a sudden I found I was less able to. And so I really just wanted to explore the possibility of getting some support because my brain did feel like it was on fire, whether or not medication might help. And so I went for assessment. That was probably the prime reason. And Tara, who did my assessment, came back with his surprise of you're both autistic and ADHD. And I was like, what? And it's funny, as I shared with, I've got a number of friends that are both autistic ADHD, and they said, oh yeah, we knew. And so it rocked my foundation because I guess I had the framework of my son as an autistic, and we're quite different. So for me, it was kind of rediscovering myself and kind of peeling back the layers and actually understanding. And it made so much sense because one of the things I find for me is the two aspects of me fight. You know, there's the ADHD part of me, which I feel like is the dominant part. It's the crazy, messy, all over the show, my brain's on fire, hamster wheel thing that's going on in my world. And then there's the autistic self that needs to eat the exact same breakfast every day. And if I don't, I don't cope. You know, certain things I struggle with. And, you know, there was a lot of things that made a lot more sense when I understood that aspect of who I was too.
Yeah, I really relate to what you said about feeling like you have the two kind of sides of yourself. I think, you know, when you're an ADHDer, you know, sometimes I feel like if you have identified one but not the other, there is a missing piece in the puzzle of understanding yourself and understanding your needs and what works for you. Because sometimes it can feel like your brain is fighting with itself. And, you know, you were sharing that you feel like you're a bit more maybe ADHD dominant and then autistic as well. So I'm more autistic dominant, but then there's the ADHD as well. So, yeah, I often see kind of those different flavors in people where one might be a bit more dominant than the other, but then they kind of fight and take turns as well. Occupational therapy, or OT, is often a recommendation for many of our neurodivergent kids and adults. Can you share with our listeners, particularly those who may not have heard of occupational therapy before, Can you explain how occupational therapists can support neurodivergent kids and adults and how they can work with neurodivergent folk in an affirming way?
One of the things I love about the profession of OT is that it's very functionally based. So it's about meeting a person where they're at rather than kind of coming in with your own framework and saying this is what you should be doing or need to be doing. It's very much about understanding where a person's at, what's important to them, what's meaningful to them, and then going from there rather than the other way around. So it's more person-centric. So it's less about you're struggling with this, therefore we will do this. It's more about what things are impacting, what you'd like to be doing or need to be doing or hope to be doing. And it's a strength-based model, but also very much looking at accommodations and thinking outside the square too. I found most OTs I've worked with, both when I was training and also clinically, very creative problem solvers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as a psychologist, I work with adults and it has been a little bit harder for me to find occupational therapists that really understand autism and ADHD and want to work with and do work with adults, because a lot of the services are still mainly based on working with children. And so, yeah, like, would love to see more people going into adult work, because adults often still need support as well across the lifespan, particularly if they are late diagnosed and have never had any OT input. But yeah, often referring to an occupational therapist can be really helpful in terms of helping ADHDers and autistic folk with how they can kind of get their day-to-day activities and their day-to-day routines actually working in a way that works for them and is taking less of a toll and making things more accessible. And so I found it's been really helpful for helping people with that, like, practical stuff and support, and then also referring to occupational therapists to do a sensory profile, particularly for autistic clients, I found has been very helpful for helping clients understand their own sensory profile and what are their triggers and what are the things they can do to regulate themselves.
Often people don't realise some of the things they seek are their certain sensory preferences. So often when I'm talking to people, it's interesting, one of the most common, or there's a couple of really common things that people lean into, I find, for sensory input, particularly when they're having trouble regulating. One is pain. Very frequently I find pain is something that's very grounding. It helps bring the mind to the present. It can help shut down what's going on in the head or in the emotional space that you're holding at the time. And so understanding whether it be pulling at hair or picking at nail beds, it can get more extreme than that. So non-suicidal cutting can be, it's incredibly prevalent. I have the privilege of people sharing privately with me their challenges. And probably one of the things that I find most rewarding is being able to just hold that space with them and reassure them that it's really common. And it's not something that necessarily needs to be fixed. I don't know if that's going to be the most popular opinion. Finding a safe option is absolutely key, and that's probably where I focus, is making sure people have a safe option for exploring that, and also the understanding behind the why they seek it and how it's helpful, just to make them feel less broken. So, and it's just looking at different options. We've developed a number of tools that give a fairly significant amount of ouch, but there are other things. And the other sensory thing that a lot of people seek is oral input. So again, it can look like chewing on fingernail, chewing on the quick, it can be chewing their clothes, it can be grinding teeth, even over talking. I think as an ADHD female, I think I tend to talk a lot, and the more stressed or the more dysregulated I am, the more I do that without taking breath, because the jaw is actually the closest moving joint to the part of the brain that drops adrenaline and cortisol. as we dysregulate, we release chemicals that, you know, engage that fright flight part, and movement actually helps drop the chemicals to turn that down again. And so the jaw being the closest moving joint is the most efficient way to actually sort of facilitate that process in the brain. And so it's really common. And often people don't realize that that's why they do those things, like that. That's why they chew. So chewing gum is actually bigger than any of my fidgets that I suggest, or any sensory tool, chewing gum. If people tolerate it, a lot of people don't tolerate chewing gum in the mouth. So we often seek crunchy foods, and that's, again, in that same family. It's giving the jaw a really good workout. I tend to seek out crunchy foods. I'm not so much a chewy person, but those things can really help. And the other thing about chewing gum, sorry, I've gone off on a tangent on chewy, is that it's a really readily accessible tool on hand. So again, you know, you don't always have a sensory support with you, or you might have forgotten it or lost it. If you're anything like me, I lose everything. So, you know, you can always get, there's usually a 7-Eleven around the corner, or a supermarket, or a colleague, or someone will have some chewy on hand. So it's helpful to know that it actually really is a useful tool. And often when I tell, you know, talk to people through this, they say, oh my goodness, my child actually is always on wanting to have chewing gum. So, and it's one of the reasons why we move so much when we're struggling to regulate. Anyone that particularly that is ADHD has heard 1,000 times over, stop moving, you're driving me crazy. It's something that we've heard a lot of. And it's actually that movement. The movement's actually the brain's super clever way of helping the person with ADHD attend. And so counterintuitively, we actually have to allow ourselves to move in order to be more present, to be able to use the front part of our brain, which is what we need when we're talking in social contexts or thinking or learning.
Yeah, I think that's so cool, like to hear that information about chewing and the jaw moving actually helping people self-regulate. To me, that makes so much sense. And what you're talking about with the chewing and seeking out, you know, crunchy foods. I've heard that from so many people as a self-regulation tool, and even movement in general. Like, I know for myself, it's actually been harder to stay still the older that I've gotten. I found like this kind of, I guess, idea or myth around people growing out of ADHD. You know, they can repress their hyperactivity and sit still when they become adults. But actually, I'm finding it harder because as you get older, life gets a bit more repetitive and you kind of have accumulated a lot more experiences by the time you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s and onwards. And life can almost get a bit more repetitive and boring, which is hard if you're an ADHDer.
No dopamine in that. Oh, no, I can completely relate to that.
Yeah, I just think it's kind of interesting. And I think what you're talking about with the chewing gum too is there are some fabulous tools. Like, for example, I've seen jewelry and, you know, like things that you can put on the end of your pencil that you can bite down on. And there's different, what's the right word for it? There's different kind of strengths of the texture of it as well. So if you want to bite down really hard or you chew a lot, there are things that are kind of will give you that feedback. And then the softer ones, I guess, thinking about what you need to regulate yourself, I often think back to kind of school. And I think it's a good thing to reflect on what did you do as a child and in primary school and high school to regulate yourself. And often people would chew on their pens or chew on their rubbers and things like that, or chew on their hair and, you know, their school uniform. So that makes a lot of sense.
And actually, like, I love the fact that you brought up the different strengths in the jewelry supports. We use ARC, or I tend to recommend ARC because they do. They have the three different strengths. But one of the things that's a bit, counterintuitive that I'd love to touch on with chew supports, because I get asked that question a lot, what one would you recommend? I chew through things, so I've gone harder. I'm still chewing through them. One of the things that's really interesting is that it makes sense that we think that if we're an aggressive chewer or we're tending to destroy chew supports or whatever it is that we're using to support that need, that we go harder and harder. You know, you need harder support. Counterintuitively, it's actually often that you need softer and also hollow. So I usually, if someone says to me, where would you recommend I start or what would you recommend? I usually say start with a hollow chew and definitely not the hardest, particularly if we're the sort of human that like bites the inside of our mouth or our fingers or straws is another one, because it's the collapse that our mouth's seeking. And when the mouth doesn't get the collapse and the give, it goes harder at the chew trying to get the collapse. So it gets more aggressive on the chew. So sometimes if someone's really destroying a chew, doing what doesn't make sense, and that's go softer and hollow, actually allows the mouth to get the support it needs or the sensory input it needs, and it has a better lifespan, and it's just, it's more satisfying for the, it's not a conscious process. It's very much, I think it happens on a more organic level.
I think it's so good that you're explaining that for people, because I wouldn't have thought of that. But I think having that understanding of the different input that people are seeking to regulate their sensory system, yeah, like hearing about those different things, that's really helpful. And I think will help our listeners. You mentioned a couple of things. You've mentioned pain, which I also see in a lot of neurodivergent clients, people seeking out pain to block out overwhelming thoughts and feelings. That makes sense because of maybe not having other strategies or knowing how to regulate themselves. You've talked about the chewing. Can you tell us about how the differences in sensory processing can impact neurodivergent people? Like, what are some of the differences in sensory processing that you would see in an autistic or ADHD person compared to a neurotypical person?
That's a great question. I tend to not think of it as them and us. I very much work within a framework when I'm unpacking it for somebody, is like, what is it that they are seeking, rather than you're autistic, therefore this might be what's supportive. I ask the same questions, really, whether it's be neurotypical. One of the things I found in COVID too, the need for sensory supports became a lot more mainstream. It wasn't necessary. The vast majority of people I spoke to either had a trauma background, a neurodiverse background, or struggling with mental health in general. But through COVID, and I think it's persisted, we're in Victoria, so we were, you know, locked down central, but very much found that the need, and I find that the vast majority of us are sensory, and we all have different sensories. I think often the sensory dial is turned up for neurodivergent people. And again, that's not for everybody, but I would say it's more common that that dial is more acutely attuned, not just in senses, but also in a lot more from an empath perspective as well. Like, I know I feel things. Like, if you tell me you've fallen over and hurt your knee, I get a sharp pain in my tummy. I can't watch TV because I literally feel the feels of everything that I'm watching. So I think the dial seems to be turned up. For me, when I'm exploring sensory needs for somebody, I'm very much unpacking the individual. I ask them, yeah, like you were saying, what have you sought out when you were a kid? What do you do now? Is it picking? Is it chewing? What do you do when you're feeling sad? What do you do when you're feeling overwhelmed? Because it's often different in different contexts. For me, when I'm feeling overwhelmed, pain's what regulates. So I use tools that give me bite, I guess, would be the way I describe it for myself. Just, again, side share. You'll often find those that find pain regulating tattoo a lot. You usually don't even need to tell me that they seek pain as a regulative tool. And often you'll hear them say, oh, yeah, when I'm feeling really overwhelmed, I'll go out and get myself a new tattoo. There's a reason why.
Yeah, piercings as well.
Oh, yes, exactly.
They're getting piercings. And I remember you actually showed me one of the tools to like help people regulate. It was this spiky bracelet and a spiky ring as well, and I found that really interesting.
And they can be just worn and people don't even know what they are, and you can be using them while you're talking to someone and someone's completely not aware that it's being used just to ground and stay present and regulated. I'll have to send you one. I've got a new tool that's just hit. It's taken me a year and a half, 2 years to sort of put, this is an overshare. I probably get myself in trouble with this one. We had to get a mold made for this tool. So it's one that you use, and so it's on a key ring rather than, because some people don't like the constriction of having something on their person. The first prototype came, and it's a pretty big deal to make a prototype in a cost perspective. It usually costs about $10,000 to do a mold. So it's pretty expensive, and it's a one-hit wonder. Like, the mold has to be right, and if it's not right, you've got to go again, same cost again. Anyway, we've never ever not had a mold work the first time, and I got the prototype of, it's called the spiky ring, so because it's a spiky and it's a key ring, so I put the words together, and the first time I got it, it didn't hurt enough, and I was really disappointed. And so I met with the factory who manufactured it for me, and I said, it doesn't hurt as much, and they're from overseas, and they don't really have as much context for, you know, the same conversations around pain and regulation. And so they're like, do you want blood? And I'm like, no, just under blood. And so this really strange conversation of me saying, I just wanted just under blood. That's a bit, I'm not sure we should. So I wanted to call it JUB, just under blood. But again, I thought, if anyone asked me where the name came from, I might get myself in trouble. But the second mold of this particular product actually nailed it, thank goodness. And yeah, it only arrived about 4 weeks ago. And it's, I love it. It's got one picking aspect, and the other one's more bitey. So when you hold it in your hands, kind of like those, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, chakra mats. So they're the spiky mats that people lie on or walk on.
Oh, the Shakti mats, yeah. I love them. I actually have one at home, and it's really great because it gives you like quite a strong sensation. Like you're kind of lying on a bed of plastic nails. Yeah, it's a very strong sensation, but I find that it tends to induce a relaxation response in the body. So I can almost fall asleep on this bed of plastic nails. Yeah.
One aspect of this new tool is literally that. So you've got a portable hand version, and a lot of people have been using it. They put it under their feet as well if they need. I hadn't thought to do that, but I've had clients share that that's what they've been doing with it. So.
Yeah, and, you know, reflecting, I guess, on the strong relaxation response that comes from using things like the Shakti mat or, you know, like the spiky bracelet, which are harm reduction ways of getting that pain response without creating permanent damage, like through breaking your skin and things like that. One of the reasons that people can sometimes seek pain out is physiologically, inducing a pain response also releases like an opiate-like effect in the brain, because your brain's going, oh, we're in pain, let's release some pain-relieving hormones. So, yeah, I think it's important to, you know, talk about this. And, you know, there can be various reasons why people will do different self-regulation strategies that involve pain. Some of them will be more emotional or, you know, mental health, or, you know, there can be a trauma component. But for a lot of autistic people in particular, yeah, it can actually be a sensory regulation component more often than not.
Mm, absolutely. It's helpful for people to understand that it's okay. It's okay to need that high sensory input is often how I'll refer to it. It's just a high sensory input. And cold sits in the same family. And I find a very big portion of neurodivergent individuals like the temperature to be quite cold. My son runs his segment of the house at about 16 degrees all the time. And I often recommend putting tools, a lot of our tools are metal, putting them in the fridge because the temperature can be very grounding as well. And I think I feel cold, and I haven't done research on it, but I feel like cold and pain sit in the same family.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I do know anecdotally from hearing from a lot of people that I've worked with and people in my life, and as I've gotten older myself, like heat, in particular hot weather and humid weather, can be quite dysregulating for neurodivergent people, you know, and that can be sometimes because of having co-occurring health conditions like POTS or Graves' disease. But it can actually be like the central feeling of sweat on your skin can be unbearable for some people. It can actually be just that it's creating a level of overwhelm that people aren't even aware of and not realizing is distressing for them until it gets out of the heat wave or until they go into air conditioning.
Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word.
One of the things I found most surprising since being diagnosed as a late identified adult is that I'm less able to regulate. Like I felt like I got more neurodistinct, if that makes sense, or the characteristics sort of heightened. And I think it was the masking dropped, but also that self-awareness that things were, rather than just pushing past them, I was honouring them in myself and recognising that it's okay that I'm struggling with that, that it made it harder for me just to push past it. But I'm a lot kinder to myself too. I find that I'm able to, probably the best way of describing it would be kinder to myself when I'm not coping and recognize, like an example, it's a little example. I was driving recently a long trip and I became acutely aware that I'd not put my hair up and that the sensation of the hair on the back of, oh, just on me, even just talking about it, it's freaking me out, was I was not coping with it. Now, usually or throughout life, I would just continue on. But it was just so significant for me. After a few minutes, I had to actually pull over and I didn't have a hair tie. So I got a mask. We all have lots of those these days. So I pulled a cord off a mask and put my hair up. But just recognizing that I needed to, you know, I needed to accommodate myself rather than actually just suck it up and push past it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think particularly for late diagnosed women, even having to think about things that are so normalized in society and culturally for us around the expectation to wear makeup all the time and have your hair done and be wearing jewelry and being, you know, well-groomed. Actually, you know, for quite a few, particularly like autistic people, wearing makeup for them or even putting on moisturizer or sunblock can be very sensory distressing. And, you know, sometimes that's hard because that goes against some of those social norms around, you know, how you're supposed to present. And even things like wearing jewelry, you know, like there'll be some times where people have said to me, I used to wear a lot of jewelry, but I just find the feeling of jewelry, particularly on, you know, maybe different parts of their body. So maybe they can't wear a necklace, but they can wear small stud earrings, or the feeling of rings is unbearable for them, or bracelets, you know, is unbearable. You just kind of, I think, knowing that all of these little things can add up and create a sensory load. And I've had people talk about how they haven't been able to work in certain workplaces or pursue a career that they wanted because the work uniform was made from polyester and was unbearable for them. And I've heard of both adult men and women talk about how, you know, they're late diagnosed, but when they were at school, they weren't able to wear the school uniform. It was unbearable and they would get in trouble all the time for not wearing their shoes or not wearing their socks. Even just having a think about some of these things, it can be like, again, it's all adding up for the person.
I love the way you talked about it in terms of sensory load or increased load, because that's exactly what happens. Like if it's hot, like you were mentioning before, all of a sudden that increased load can then mean something that you can cope with normally, you can't today. And so also important to remind ourselves that sometimes we might only have like 30% to give, or we can only tolerate X amount, and that's 100% of today's best. It's not that you're only giving 30%, you're actually giving 100% of what you have available today. And again, it's just that self-kindness, because I think one of the things that can happen, we tend to be very harsh on ourselves. We're often our worst critics. I definitely overthink things. I can just say slightly the wrong thing and I'll ruminate on it inside my head for at least the rest of the day, sometimes, you know, way longer than that. And it's probably something that the other person's not even thinking about. So I think that that self-reflection and that self-talk can be so loud to us sometimes. So just being kinder to ourselves and understanding. And that's one of the things, like, I think it's really good to be able to talk to others about the good, the bad, the ugly. We often get accused of oversharing, but I think in that oversharing, we get to hear or bear witness to other people's journeys as well, and hear that we're not really that alone. It might look differently for you as it does for me, but there's that still that shared understanding. I almost get like really excited in those moments of overshare, because you sort of, it lights me up, because you kind of feel like it's kind of like a thread that sits between the two of you. And I don't know how to explain it other than that. It just sort of feels like this thread that lights up. And I feel less alone and feel very validated and more okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think hearing people's stories and their experiences, it can normalize what people are going through, particularly if you've gone through life feeling different and feeling, you know, quote unquote, weird and like you don't fit in. And then you suddenly hear other people talking about things that you felt or thought or experienced, and it makes you feel like you have that sense of belonging, which I think is really important for all of us, you know, as human beings. And it's really good for our mental health as well. What are some further sensory accommodations and strategies or tools that people can use to help themselves with regulating their emotions, their executive functioning, and their sensory processing? And how can we normalize these in different environments like school, universities, the workplace, the shop?
I think the first thing is just understanding that they are important rather than the tools themselves, that fundamental understanding that sensory is a need, and that sensory tools aren't a distraction. They're a way of us both grounding and gaining movement to help keep the brain less in its fright-flight state, so that you can access the bit that needs to do the thinking and the learning and the processing. So I guess, firstly, I think it's just that people need to understand that sensory tools are not a distraction. They're, for the vast majority who use them, just like glasses. Understanding that things like we've touched on, chewing gum, is equally a valid sensory support, or it can be deep pressure can be a sensory support, or it can be high sensory input, i.e. pain or cold. It could be something soft and squishy. The other thing is that they don't have to look like toys. They can be interchangeable. So there can be things that you can use that are toys and repurpose. And there's nothing wrong with that. If, you know, if you're into squishmallows, you only have to go to a Comic-Con. Have you ever been to a Comic-Con?
No, I haven't, because I probably would find it a bit overwhelming. But I do have to say that the kind of basket full of squishmallows in Kmart gets me every time. Every time I go to Kmart, I just like to go over and hug them all and like look at them, and they're just so cute. And like the feel is so perfect. I just love them a lot. So you see, like the other neurodivergent people in the store are all crowded around the squishmallow display and like kind of like, you know, give each other a look, and you're like, yeah,
you're my tribe and I see you. Well, you just go to a Comic-Con sometime. Like, I'm not into, you know, DC Comics and all of the things D&D, that's as far from my interest as it could possibly be. But surprisingly, so we exhibited last year for the first time at Comic-Con, and literally I've never been, I think there's a force field, and unless you're neurodivergent, you can't enter. And it just was the most validating, gorgeous, like I was like so lit up with excitement. And I expected to be more overwhelmed, because I often find when I'm at events, my cup gets depleted pretty quickly because I have to be concentrating it on, and people are sharing really personal stuff, and there can be a crowd waiting to be served, but I don't want to leave the person I'm with. And so there's a lot going on for me, lots of layers that make it really hard for me to push through. I lean into a lot of sensory supports when I'm at those. But at Comic-Con, it was quite the opposite. I came away so energized and excited because it was just literally a building full of neurodivergent individuals living their best life, doing them, and unapologetically rocking whatever it is that, you know, lit them up, which was amazing. So, sorry, I segued, but, you know, it's totally fine to walk around with a squishmallow if that's, as an adult, that's what you want to do. But it's also that there are plenty of sensory supports out there, and that's one of the things that we've, I guess, really focused on, is having tools that are really discreet, that don't bring attention to somebody. Also just understanding, you know, things like sound, different levels of sound. There's the loops that people can use to help filter. So one of the things that people, and or vibes, we have vibes, the loops are a much funkier version of. But sound travels in bandwidths, and high and low frequencies are the things that tend to trigger us the most. And the way the noise filtering devices like loops and vibes work is that they take out the high and the low frequency, or they dampen it a lot, so that main bandwidth of the mid-range, which is where speech tends to sit, can still come through with clarity, but the triggering sounds, high and low, are filtered out. So they can be really helpful. Probably the other accommodation that I'm gobsmacked that people still expect it from us, that eye contact is somehow mandatory for human contact. Eye contact is often overwhelming. I didn't realize how much I find it overwhelming, and that if I'm really concentrating, eye contact is not something that's helpful for me, and just being okay with that. I think when I was first became an OT, one of the things that, you know, they trained to do is help children that are autistic give eye contact. That is the opposite of what's helpful in my books. Well, unless it's important for that child to give eye contact. So again, for me, it's very much about what's important to the individual, what do they want to work on. One of the things I see a lot when a family are in front of me face to face, you know, mum will pick up typically the hand caterpillar, which is the one with the beads that roll, and you watch, their shoulders will drop. And you'll see an immediate response to that product. And their 11-year-old son will pick up the cog that has a high spin and a slight vibration. And they're like, oh, mum, can I get this? Can I get this? Can I get this? I love this. I love this. And you can see the joy they're getting from a whole range of aspects of that particular fidget. And the mum will pick it up, feel it, and it does nothing for them. And like, no. Feel this. This is the one you should get. And that's two different sensory needs playing out, and trying to gently remind the mum that it is so individual. The other one that we haven't touched on, which is important to understand, that's part of our sensory diet, is food and texture. I think we often get accused of being fussy eaters. I like to see it as we have sensory palates, and it's no different to our touch or our hearing, our taste and our tongues and our mouths and all of the things. You know, that is sensory as well. It's one of the senses. And just remembering that's it, we've got to honour that as well. A beautiful example I read or heard once, and it stuck with me. You know, my son has a very sensory profile. He has only a couple of safe foods that he'll eat. And so for the vast majority of people, they would look at his diet, and I would call it a beige diet, you know, nuggets, any version of nugget, like a schnitzel, that's a big nugget. There's nuggets, there's, you know, chicken strips, a long nugget. sausages, mashed potato. Interesting, he likes mashed potato, but it is beige-ish. You know, I spent probably the first 7 years of his life worrying if he had the right nutrition and stressing about it. And I read, I'm pretty sure it was an article, and it talked about, you know, it's a sensory palate. And they said, you know, if you were at a dinner party and you sat down and someone served you raw chicken, there's nothing that could make you eat it. You know, you couldn't eat it. And I remember as a mum thinking, yeah, I would gag. I couldn't. And they said, so when you put something in front of your sensory human and they don't want to eat it, remind yourself that it's their raw chicken. And from that moment on, I not ever once stressed about what he did or didn't eat. And it's okay to have safe things. And so I stopped beating myself up as a mum. I really like that raw chicken analogy. So I hope that helps somebody listening.
I think it really will, because with sensory stuff, it is such a physiological like experience. I remember seeing this pyramid diagram. I think it's an occupational therapy sort of diagram. And it had all of these kind of the sensory needs, you know, in our senses. So hearing, smell, sight, touch, taste. Then we have the vestibular sense, which is kind of like your balance. Proprioception, which is, you know, where is your body compared to other objects in space, like spatial awareness. And then the eighth sense is interoception, which we have talked about on the podcast before, which is your ability to be able to like A, notice, and B, accurately kind of tell what your internal organs and what your body is kind of saying to you. But like all of those needs need to be met, and they're at the bottom of the pyramid. For people then to get up to the top of the pyramid, which was like behavioral regulation, activating what you're saying before, Joe, like the frontal cortex, your executive functioning, and then learning and emotional regulation. So I think it's really understanding that covering the sensory and the physiological stuff first, that really should be a priority, and that bottom of the pyramid needs to be in place for these other things to happen. And food can really be a big thing for neurodivergent people. Like people can either be sensory seeking and almost maybe eating a lot more than they would like to because they are trying to self-soothe, right, through sensory seeking with food. Or it might be, you know, actually really struggling to get enough nutrition and enough fluids and things in because of sensory differences and sensory processing. So I think if we can come to it through like a non-judgmental lens and just note that, you know, these things aren't bad or good, they're actually bodily needs, and being curious and compassionate about it from being a parent or being the person who is neurodivergent, being a teacher, being a therapist, being a health professional. Yeah, I think this is why it's so important for us to be having this conversation and talking about it.
Absolutely. And also having those conversations with our young humans as well, so that they understand, because often the things that we seek get misread or assumed as being you're misbehaving or you're trying to distract, or and actually those things, those sensory seeking behaviours are literally you're trying to regulate. You're trying to do your very best to give what's required here and now, whether it be in a social context or an education context. I find it interesting, like in schools, this is a conversation that I have regularly with educators, and it's logical again to assume that, you know, kids have been out at snack and lunch and they've been doing lots of running around and playing. And so when they come in, you kind of think, well, they've got their wriggles out or they've got all their activity out. So now it's time to come in and sit and learn. But the thing is that we don't necessarily have a front of mind is for, I think, the vast majority of primary school kids, whether they be neurodistinct or neurotypical, it's a little bit crazy out there and there's lots of regulation issues. But as we get older, so moving to secondary, it becomes, I think, a little bit more apparent for those that are neurodistinct that there's a lot of things that cause dysregulation, whether it be my sandwich is squished, it's hot, my clothes aren't feeling comfortable, I didn't understand that social exchange, what just happened there. There's a lot of things that overwhelm, and we're hit that instinctive or survival part of our brain, and we're in fight flight when we come into the classroom. And unless we get to move, whether that be big movement, and I often say to teachers, if you could just get your students moving for even if it's just 2 or 3 minutes before they sit and learn, the vast majority will actually quieten down that instinctive response and allow them to attend better. And often those that are neurodistinct will need additional sensory supports.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the things that I have kind of seen is that movement as you get older, the expectation changes when you get into high school. Oh, you should be able to sit still for longer. You should be able to learn quietly for longer. And then when you get into university or work afterwards, it's, you know, there are even more sort of normative expectations on you. But actually, for me, for example, like I have a sit-stand desk at home, so I can alternate between sitting and standing. If I had a preference, I would have loved to have sit on a rocking chair for all of primary school, high school, uni, and if I ever had to work an office job, I would be rocking backwards and forwards on that rocking chair, like at the desk, because I find it very regulating. This is where we have people go for walks. You know, every hour they get up and they'll go for a little walk around the office, or in their lunch break, they can't go and eat in the lunchroom with everybody else. Sure. Because, you know, that's overloading and they need to get up and get out of the office and go for a walk to get that movement in. So, yeah, like there are so many things that people aren't aware of that they may be already doing to regulate themselves. But then there are other things that people aren't aware of that could be brought into things like schools and workplaces.
Absolutely. And if there is a student, like, and I know that it, of course it does happen. You have a student, for example, that's flinging a fidget or flinging their sensory support around, rather than make a big deal out of it, just remove it and just say, look, when you're ready to use it appropriately, or, you know, I'll give it back to you. And I find too, if you don't make a big deal out of using it and allow it there for all students, it shouldn't just be like that's the box of things for those students here that are neurodivergent. It's for anybody that needs it. A funny moment I had at an expo. I had this teacher, she was very old school, and she was standing and she was like, what are these about? What are these for? I don't agree with these in schools. It was an education conference. And so I was obvious that I was there promoting them for use in schools. And she was not an enthusiast about it. So I started to talk to her a little bit about how the brain works and the science behind why it's helpful to use tools that are both quiet and provide sensory support. And she's like, no, I think they're ridiculous. I refuse to let my students use it. And I was frustrated internally. And I do, the older I've got, my filter for what I say it's narrowed. I'm not as good at filtering, but I was being very good. And I was not telling her what I was thinking. But the interesting thing is, and I did reflect this to her gently, is the entire time she was talking to me, she was obviously a little heightened by the conversation because we had differing opinions. The entire time she was fidgeting with her lanyard, like she was stimming with it. And towards the end of the conversation, I just said, it's interesting, you know, you're talking about that fidgeting or using sensory supports is unhelpful, but I've noticed that while you've been talking to me that you've been using your lanyard very much as a sensory support. Are you aware that that's exactly what we're talking about? And it's true, teachers often need sensory supports too. And one of the things I regularly talk about with schools as well is when they're talking about their students and what would I recommend or what are the best tools, it's like, we also need to look at supports for teachers because it's pretty overwhelming. You know, it's probably my top list of careers I would not do is in a classroom with kids. So not that I don't love kids. I love kids. That just sounded wrong. But it's just a really challenging thing to steward so many unique humans in one space. Wow.
Okay, Jo, so we've had a great chat today about, you know, different sensory needs and accommodations. And you talked with us a bit about like how Kaiko's Fidgets came about. One of the things that really drew me to your business was the fact that your son, Kai, who is autistic, designs like his own line of fidgets. Mm-hmm. And they looked really cool. Like they looked like they were designed for teens and adults. Yeah. So what's it been like to run this business with your son, Kai, and other family members?
Oh, look, it's honestly been such a privilege. It really commenced, as we touched on earlier, as an unfolding of Kai's sensory needs. So we didn't set out to run a business. He was getting teased. He was in grade four and he was using a Tangle, which he still loves, actually. And his peers were telling him to go play with the preps, and he was coming home in tears feeling like he didn't want to use his sensory supports at school because he was getting teased for them. But he needed them in order to attend. He was struggling with learning. He's dyslexic as well, so he really struggled academically. And so we problem solved with him, and we came up with the idea of working with metal and trying to design something that was jointed like a Tangle, but that was made out of metal that would look a little bit more acceptable in his older primary. And he started taking them to school. So like we experimented, we Googled how to degrease chains, and it said use Kero. I think it was petrol, one of them, I'm not sure. Anyway, that was a sensory nightmare. but so we fiddled around, and we, you know, his first couple of fidgets that he made, he took to school, and instead of being teased, his peers were like, "Oh, where'd you get that?" And he's like, "I made it." "You did not," was the response. So he took a bunch in that he'd made and shared with his cohort that he went to school with. And the response was really good. The thing I liked most, though, was that Kai, for the first time in his life, like he'd seen psychologists and he'd had occupational therapy. We'd done so many programs to try and help him, because from a very young age, because he was so significantly struggling, he told me most days he didn't want to live. And so he was sad. He was acutely aware of how different he was, and that made him really sad. And for the first time in his life, no matter how awesome as a parent I tell him he is, you know, his academic, his social and his sporting prowess told him he sucked to him. And so for the first time in his life, he was my son. His peers, his teachers were telling him the impact that his little things that he were making was having. And for the first time I saw him, you know, his chest puff out, because he was actually doing something that was cool and different. And so we lent into that and started doing little markets with his fidgets. And that's actually where it began. It was quite by accident doing markets, but it was the best thing for his self-esteem. I honestly feel like it sounds like a bit melodramatic, but it saved him and it helped him unleash his entrepreneurial and his left of center thinking, which is just so beautiful. Like I constantly remind my boys, not too much in the world that's been invented that is miraculous and life-changing has come from a neurotypical human. It's those that think outside the box and you know, test limits that a force change. And so I've watched that come alive in my son, and I love the fact that he's really comfortable in his own skin. But it's been a journey, and sort of exploring that with him as a business has been, I can't put words to how incredibly grateful I am that we accidentally discovered that this was the thing for him.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, and I think it's really cool how it's sort of like turned what has been painful through almost alchemy into like a really specialty area of skill, and actually creating things that really help others and give joy to others as well, you know. And I see that a lot in people. Sometimes it's, you know, whether you've been through difficult things or you've had certain difficulties, it really gives you that empathy because you've been through it, to understand what someone else's struggles and needs have been, and then to sometimes come up with those really creative solutions. Yeah, so that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that story. So So, Jo, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast today and talk about all things sensory. For our last question today, do you have any other strengths that you'd like to share that your neurodivergence has given you, or a favourite moment or story that shows how your brain works?
I think one of the things that's particularly great about the way a neurodistinct brain works is that we do hyperfocus. And when we're passionate about something, we can really drill down, and it's almost like the dial goes up, or you get supervision. And I love the fact that that can really help with product design and development. And so you hear something small and it becomes very expanded in your brain. And so many of the tools that have come into being through our meanderings of exploring others' sensory has been that journey with others, but that acute attunement to hearing it and being able to expand it into something that's not yet in existence. I really love that. When we are passionate about something, we do hyper-focus on it. And so it doesn't feel like work. And that's one of the things I encourage. Mainstream work is difficult, I think, for teens and adults. When you have a different neurotype, often it's the sensory things that do get in the way of a more typical work environment. But that doesn't mean that we can't be really effective in a work environment. And I haven't found too many humans. This beautiful story, and I'm sharing with permission, he sings it from the rooftop, this beautiful gentleman, Damien, who is obsessed with spinners. He came to us, he discovered our spinners, and he'd visit us weekly with his support worker. And he hadn't been able to get meaningful work. He'd struggled to find even volunteer work that he could do. He had complex physical needs and a range of difficulties. And his passion was spinners. And I often say to people, when you're passionate about something, try and lean into that for work. You know, like, how can you turn that into something that you can do? And so over the last 3 or 4 months, we've had the privilege of walking alongside Damien. I encouraged him that he was so obsessed. He's completely blind. He has cerebral palsy. So he has a number of challenges that make it difficult to work in what you would expect a work environment. Anyway, I talked to him about possibly setting up a little market stall, a bit like what Kai did, and selling spinners. And he's done that. And he's now on a weekly basis doing markets, selling spinners. And he, for the first time, he's 27, and he's doing him, and he's doing it in his passion and embracing it. And I love the fact we've got to witness that journey just through sparking an idea. It doesn't need to look like working for someone. We can do it for ourselves. You know, some people need to work at nighttime. Some people need to work in 1 hour bursts. Some people need to work lying on the floor. You can do that. You can do it often best when you work for yourself.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that story and your strengths. Passion is everything. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And we usually have it with abundance, don't we?
Yes, definitely. It's really all or nothing for a lot of neurodivergent people. Awesome. So if people would like to connect with Kaiko Fidgets and with yourself, what is the best way for them to do that, Jo?
Well, we have a website. So that's www.kaikofidgets.com. And Kaiko is spelled K-A-I-K-O. So it's a combination of Kai, which is my son's name, and Kobe, K-O, so Kaiko Fidgets. I'm also on email. So if people, I get several emails a day with people just wanting me to help unpack what might suit them best, more than happy to do that. And they can just get me on jo@kaikofidgets.com. And we've got social, so we've got Insta, TikTok, and Facebook for Kaiko Fidgets, so they can reach out. I'm not particularly great at responding to DMs. My DM will tell them to email me because I get a bit overwhelmed with all the things. So, more than happy to field questions anytime.
Sounds great. Thanks for sharing, Jo.
You're so welcome, and thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman Podcast or our website ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.